From KCPW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Socialism is a dirty word for many these days, but 100 years ago, the socialist presence was alive and well in America, including here in Utah. In fact, over 100 socialist men and women were elected to public office in 24 Utah cities and towns. A socialist column was published every Sunday in the Ogden newspaper, and the Old Saltaire Resort of the Great Salt Lake hosted the state's annual Socialist Days Festival. A new book traces Utah's little-known radical roots, and today on the program, we're talking about the history of radicalism in Utah. Plus, a happy anniversary, U.S. Constitution. Today marks the founding document's 225th anniversary of its signing. All that and your calls coming up after the news. Good morning. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Radicalism in Utah. It doesn't seem to compute, does it? The Utah of the 21st century is known for its social and political conservatism, but surprisingly, the Beehive State has a long tradition of radical social movements. From creating the communal United Order movement by pioneer settlers to electing members of the Socialist Party of America to local office, Utah hasn't always been the reddest state. Today on the program, we're talking about the history of Utah radicalism and the state's ongoing small but vocal revolutionary streak. Joining me in studio, John McCormick. He is Dean of the School of Humanities and Social Sciences at Salt Lake Community College. He's published many books and articles, including The Gathering Place and the historic buildings of downtown Salt Lake City. And he joins me in studio. Professor McCormick, thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome.
Also with us, John Sillito. He's an adjunct professor at Weber State University, as well as professor emeritus of libraries at Weber State. He's also the author of numerous books, including Women in Utah History, A World We Thought We Knew, and others. McCormick and Sillito are co-authors of the new book, A History of Utah Radicalism, Startling, Socialistic, and Decidedly Revolutionary. It's the winner of Utah State History's 2012 Francis Armstrong Madsen Best History Book Award, and they'll be accepting their award and launching the 60th annual Utah State History Conference this weekend at historic Fort Douglas. More information on that as we go. But John Sillito, welcome to you.
My pleasure.
Later on in the program, we'll turn to our enduring founding document, the U.S. Constitution, which celebrates a 225th anniversary today. But first, Utah's radical roots. If you've got questions or comments about early socialist politicians or socialist newspapers or the modern school, you can give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Gentlemen, let's get some definitions out of the way. What do you mean by radicalism before we get started? John Sillito?
Well, I think particularly in this book, what we're talking about is left-wing radicalism, socialists. There's radicalism on various sides of the political spectrum. By socialism, I think what the socialists of the early 20th century meant, and the way we understand it to be, would be the collective ownership and democratic management of those essential aspects of society, the things that everyone needs to have a good and productive life. So we're focusing in on that left-wing socialist organization in Utah.
John McCormick, why? Why the lefty side of things? I mean, certainly there are fringe groups on the right side of the political spectrum. Why did you focus on the left groups?
Well, I think because, first of all, that is the kind of radicalism and the kind of radical tradition both in Utah and the United States that's always resonated most with me, that I found most interesting. Second of all, it's been neglected, you know, so that when we say to people, did you know there was a time in the early 20th century when there was a significant movement for socialism in Utah, when 115 socialists were elected to office, including a socialist to the state legislature? Did you know there were, on three occasions, the State Federation of Labor endorsed the Socialist Party? people are surprised. They can hardly believe that. That doesn't sound like the kind of Utah they're used to thinking about.
Hmm. In the book, you call it a footnote, that radicalism in Utah is really a footnote in history. Why hasn't it garnered more attention? Because it does surprise a lot of people. It certainly surprised me.
Sure.
John Sillitoe, what do you think?
Well, I think historians choose what they study, and in graduate school, historians have graduate advisors who direct them on what they study. And historians prior to the early 1980s had not really looked at this phenomenon. I don't think it's a surprise that both John and I look at it from a different perspective because we are products of post-war America, and we experienced a kind of a radical tradition around us as we were beginning our study. I think one of the important things about this topic, sometimes people say to me, is this a local study? Yes, it is. It is a local study, but hopefully not a parochial study. Hopefully it tells us as much about a broader left-wing tradition in the United States as it does about the activities here in Utah.
Mm-hmm. Again, another definition, socialism. As we go on this conversation, what do we mean by socialist tendencies, philosophies, politics, John McCormick?
Well, what John said a minute ago about the collective ownership of the means of production, et cetera, in an effort to build what socialists call the cooperative commonwealth. That was part of it, but a large part of it was socialists defined themselves in opposition to capitalists, and they defined socialism in opposition to capitalism. So what they said is they were advocating a system that was not based on the profit motive, that was not based on the private ownership of the means of production, that was not based on competition, as of course, you know, which are key features of the capitalistic system. What they said is that that kind of a system based on profit motive, et cetera, creates all kinds of persistent and growing problems, poverty, inequality, exploitation, alienation, et cetera, and the way to address and those problems will never be addressed until we change the basic system. So a minute ago you said, what do we mean by radicalism? We mean a point of view that advocates thoroughgoing change in the fundamentals of the way a society and a political and economic system is organized.
Politics, economics. I mean, to me, it's interesting that the kernels stem all the way back to the early settlers of this state, the kernels of radicalism. Because when I think of the Westward Ho movement, I think of rugged individualism. I'm not thinking of collectivism, of socialism per se. Mm-hmm. John Sillitoe, did that strike you as kind of odd as well?
Well, it did initially when we began our research, because the Mormons bring with them to Utah a longstanding cooperative tradition. It was one of the features of Mormonism that bothered a lot of people in 19th century America. One of the things that I found very interesting as a parallel, the Mormons believed in an all-encompassing lifestyle. Religion was a part of a broader set of factors that brought people together. And the socialists believed that as well. While they were political in the sense that they pursued power through the electoral process, politics was just one part of a broader socialist culture that included encampments and orchestras and lectures and newspapers. And again, I don't want to get too generational here, but I think for people that grew up in the 1960s who saw a cultural movement that included some kind of political aspect, I think it's easier to understand what socialists were advocating and how socialists were operating here in Utah. And the Mormon connection is interesting. We identify a number of active Latter-day Saints who were also active socialists. We refer to them as socialist saints, who saw that combination of religion and politics as making sense. Now, the LDS Church hierarchy didn't see it as making sense, and they strongly opposed it. But for individuals, they could make it work.
Speaking with John Sillitoe, he's an adjunct professor at Weber State University. Also with us, John McCormick, dean of the School of Humanities and Social Science at Salt Lake Community College. They are co-authors of the new book, A History of Utah Radicalism, Startling, Socialistic, and Decidedly Revolutionary. It's the winner of this year's Utah State History Best History Book Award, and they'll be accepting their award and launching the 60th annual Utah State History Conference this weekend at historic Fort Douglas. And of course, there are more details and links on our website, kcpw.org. But if you'd like to join us, if you've got questions or comments about this slice of Utah history, 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. We were talking about the impact of Mormons on a small group of Mormons that embraced socialism. And interestingly, the first movement that you highlight in the book is this Mormon-based movement called the United Order. John McCormick, can you describe what this utopian community wanted to create?
Yes, as John said a minute ago, you know, early Mormons were communitarians. You know, they had a collectivist point of view. We sometimes characterize them as utopian socialists. One thing that meant is that they advocated and tried to practice at one time or another a system they called the United Order, a socialistic economic system based on the principles, essentially, as one historian said, based on the belief that everyone should get what they need in terms of material goods. No one should get more than they need, and everyone should be equal, basically, in the sight of God and in each other in terms of material goods.
Now, Mormonism, of course, was not founded in Utah. It traveled here from the East. Had they tried the United Order elsewhere, or was this kind of the first place where it started?
No, they traveled. You're right. It was founded, of course, in New York State in 1830. I guess, very quickly, the founder of that church, Joseph Smith, within a couple of years after its founding, said God had revealed to him the ideal economic order, something called the United Order, and they attempted to put that into practice before they came to Utah. They come to Utah 17 years later, begin coming to Utah in 1847, and once they get into Utah, they try once again on several occasions, the latest in the 1880s, to implement that kind of a system.
Now, the difference between socialism and the United Order, though, was it's not merely a political economic transformation of society. It had a theocracy at the top, right, John mm-hmm. Sillitoe?
Yes, indeed. And for many Mormons who were inclined toward the Socialist Party, they could make the two work because they saw the United Order aspect as an economic part and the Socialist Party as a political means to attain that. The hierarchy of the LDS Church, however, saw it completely differently, and at various times not only would discourage individual Mormons from joining the Socialist Party or any other radical left groups, but specifically by the 1930s, when the United Order is replaced by something called the Church Welfare Program, they were specifically saying to Latter-day Saints, socialism, communism is not the United Order. The United Order is of God. These other things are of man, and therefore they're very, very different.
Mm. Speaking with John Sillitoe, adjunct professor at Weber State University, also Dean John McCormick of the School of Humanities and Social Science at Salt Lake Community College, talking about their new book, A History of Utah Radicalism, winner of this year's Utah State History's Best History Book Award. More information on our website, kcpw.org. We're talking about a little-known history of radicalism in our now conservative Beehive State. If you'd like to join our conversation, if you've got questions or comments about radicalism here in Utah, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. We need to take a short break. We'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. Utah is now known as a conservative stronghold, but a century ago, there was a bit more political diversity. And in fact, there was a small but significant slice of the population who embraced socialism. A new book documents Utah's radical roots. And today on the program, we're talking about the history of radicalism here in the Beehive State with my guest, John McCormick, Dean of the School of Humanities and Social Science at Salt Lake Community College, and John Sillitoe, an adjunct professor at Weber State. They are the co-authors of the new book, A History of Utah Radicalism, Startling, Socialistic, and Decidedly Revolutionary. It's the winner of this year's Utah State History Best History Book Award, and they will be accepting that award in conjunction with the upcoming 60th annual Utah State History Conference being held this weekend at historic Fort Douglas. You can find out a lot more information on our website, kcpw.org. But if you'd like to join us, if you've got questions or comments about radicalism here in the state of Utah, 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. We were talking about the connection between the Mormon Church and the socialist philosophy. The church quickly denounced socialism shortly after many of its members started to embrace it. Why do you think that is, John Sillitoe? I mean, was it subversive to their authority? What was it?
Well, I think it probably was that, but I think it was part of a larger movement on the part of leaders of the LDS Church in a period when they were trying to achieve statehood and become very much part of the mainstream in America and not on the fringes. Historians have referred to that as the Americanization process, where Mormonism gives up its distinctive features, communalism, theocracy, polygamy, in favor of mainstream values. Mm. So I think it was a combination of things. I think the LDS Church was as much anti-labor radicalism as it was anti-political radicalism. And to have any of its members involved with things that seem to draw away from that larger goal of putting Mormonism within a larger capitalist framework was probably threatening to them, yeah.
Can you put the Socialist Party in a broader context for us? I mean, the rise of the Socialist Party occurred early 20th century here in Utah. What else was going on in the country generally when it came to these left-wing political movements?
Well, first of all, you know, you find socialist movements emerging in the United States before the early 20th century, but the time when there's a real mass movement for socialism of some significance is the early 20th century, from around 1900 to 1920 or 1925. But that's not the only left-wing radical movement of the time, either in Utah or the rest of the country. It was the time when the Wobblies, the international industrial workers of the world, emerge. And they were a significant presence, particularly strong in certain parts of the country, and they were a significant presence here in Utah. A colleague of ours recently wrote a really important book on one of the members of the Wobblies, Joe Hill, for example. There had always been an anarchist movement, a left-wing and right-wing anarchist movement in the late 19th, early 20th century. The left-wing movement centered around Emma Goldman and Alexander Berkman. Goldman makes some visits to Salt Lake, spoke here half a dozen times at least. In fact, we discuss in the book another anarchist who visited Utah and was sympathetic with the plight of the Mormons, with the pressure they were getting. So, and of course, there was an increasingly strong labor movement of all kinds, from conservative to radical labor movements. So there was a lot going on in the context of what I would call, first of all, an emerging, rapidly emerging capitalist order, a corporate capitalist order, and second of all—
So this was a reaction to that?
Very much a reaction to what I would call naked capitalism.
Okay. The Utah brand of socialism, mm-hmm. did it look any different from what was sweeping the nation at all?
You know, it in large patterns resembled the Socialist Party nationally in terms of who joined it. It had a strong working class base, but it was attractive to professional people and clergy and school teachers and farmers. You know, obviously the difference in Utah is that through our study, we've figured that approximately 40% of the Utah Socialist Party were members of the LDS Church, and that's something you don't find elsewhere, obviously. But beyond that, the party in Utah looked very much like the party around the country. The party believed strongly in the ballot box. They were going to bring socialism to America through the electoral process. And when Debs, who ran for president five times, was receiving 5 or 6% of the vote nationally, that's about what he was receiving here in Utah. And the party elected a number of people to a number of offices in the state of Utah. And they ultimately believed that electoral action was significantly the key to change. In 1912, for example, 100 years ago, the election then, there were four candidates running for president, three of whom were certainly progressives, one of whom, Eugene Debs, was a socialist. And the real issue was, how can we make early 20th century America better for more people? And it was quibbling over details, is not over broad strokes.
It's interesting. I mean, in the book you mentioned that over 2,000 people came to hear Debs in Liberty Park, in Salt Lake City. It's not just a couple of people, a couple of cottage meetings. This philosophy really appealed to thousands here in Utah.
It did. And in fact, it was very interesting. We discovered that Debs would come to big cities like Salt Lake or Ogden and draw a big crowd. But there would be socialist lectures that would take place in small communities throughout the state that didn't bring in big name socialist leaders. And hundreds of people would go to the meeting and stay for hours and talk about it. That's what I was saying earlier about, in many ways, the Socialist Party was part of a larger alternative culture that included things like speech making and music and entertainment, and it was an amazing phenomenon, and again pretty typical of what was going on throughout the country.
Another outlet for the socialist ideologues was something called the Modern School. So there was actually a school that was established here in Salt Lake City, part of a larger national trend, as you mentioned, John Sillito. John McCormick, were students actually enrolling in the Modern School here in Salt Lake?
Yes, they were, and that's an interesting, was an interesting experiment. It lasted for a couple of years, but it was a private school system actually modeled on the educational philosophies of a Spanish activist named Francisco Ferrer, and started, a number of them were established throughout the United States, but the second one to be established in the United States was established in Salt Lake City, Utah. It was established as an alternative to the public school system. Socialists always had mixed feelings about the public school system. On the one hand, they said, you know, it can be an important institution, a democratic institution, a way of bringing people together. On the other hand, they said it can often just be one more capitalist way of spreading capitalist propaganda. So they felt the need to establish a private school that would teach socialist and radical and labor values. It was intended to attract both high school age students and adults, so it operated on a variety of levels. The leading person behind it was a guy named William Thurston Brown, who was the Unitarian minister in Salt Lake City at the time. And I think also
Another important figure in it was a woman named Virginia Snow Stephen, who was the daughter of LDS Church President Lorenzo Snow, a progressive educator and artist, and later we've mentioned Joe Hill, later one of the defenders of Joe Hill was involved in it.
So I guess my point, the point John was making, lots of things were going on because what socialists said is we're not just opposing an economic system, we're opposing a whole way of life, and we're interested in establishing, therefore, a whole new way of life, a different economic, political system, a whole different system of cultural values and practices.
I was surprised to read about the role of the media in spreading this socialist message, and that a major newspaper in the state of Utah, the Ogden Examiner, published a weekly column dedicated to the socialist message. I mean, how did that happen, and how long did it run? John Cilito?
It ran for several years, and it came as a result of a very significant, little-known but amazing woman in Utah named Kate Hilliard, who came to Utah as a non-Mormon in the 1880s, became very much involved first in suffrage, and worked with Latter-day Saint women in that capacity. Then later, as an avowed socialist, played a major role in the Utah Federation of Women's Clubs. But she was a writer, and she organized with some comrades the socialist department of the Examiner, it was in those days. And later, when she broke with the Socialist Party and affiliated with the Socialist Labor Party, there were two columns, one representing the Socialist Party, one representing the Socialist Labor Party. Ogden always had an active socialist movement, in part because of the railroads. That was a big part of it, but not just the only part of it. There was another individual named Olin Kennedy, who was the sort of a gadfly and the leading figure in the Socialist Party for nearly 40 years, bringing Debs and Thomas and others to Utah, and active in the Socialist Party nationally and regionally as well. So there was a kind of a core group in Ogden for a long, long time, and they were able to convince, I think, the newspaper that there were readers that would buy their paper if it featured that kind of exchange of ideas.
But Ogden was by no means the only place where you could see socialist activists very invested in their communities. As you mentioned, John McCormick, 115 members of the Socialist Party were elected to local office, and I'm talking city council, justices of the peace. Were these partisan offices, or were they largely nonpartisan, but somehow the ideology filtered into public policy?
As John said a minute ago, most Utah socialists believe that socialism would come through the ballot, not the bullet, that is, as peacefully as a result of elections. And so they ran for office from the very beginning and met with success right from the start. So the first socialists elected in Utah were elected in 1901 in Lehi and Salina, and I think Elsinore down in San Pete County. What they're doing is trying to fill elective offices of all kinds, hoping to make a difference. The question is, what difference could they make? And what we said is that, you know, if they're a lone socialist on a city council — Henry W. Lawrence was a socialist member of the Salt Lake City Council in 1911, their influence might be limited. But there were occasions when the mayor and the majority of the city council in some Utah cities and towns were socialists. So they were in a position to do some things and make a difference. And so we were particularly interested in those cities and towns, places like Eureka and Bingham and Mammoth and like that.
So what did they do once they, you know, won at the ballot box? Was it targeting wages? Was it looking at working conditions? I mean, what sort of institutional changes or policies did they try to incorporate in their leadership? John McCormick?
Well, the very kinds of things you're talking about. When they were elected to office, what they said is, you know, we're criticized as being starry-eyed idealists. We're criticized as being out of touch. We're criticized of being incapable of concentrating on day-to-day affairs that an elected official has to. But we're going to prove them wrong, and so we're going to be honest, and we're going to be efficient. We're going to make sure that city services improve. improve, and we're going to make sure that we have water systems and clean streets and a Department of Health. We're going to make sure that we advocate for fair working conditions for workers. We're going to have we're going to make sure that we are. We do the kinds of things that ordinary people, both in their working lives and their ordinary lives, need and expect from government.
Hmm. We've only got a few minutes left. John Sillitoe, we've got several decades to cover. In the book, you mentioned that Utah radicalism was really at the peak in the early 20th century. Mm-hmm. In the years that followed, you still can see how... the socialist tendencies and some of these radical movements were very present in Utah history. Just name a couple highlights for us, if you would.
You see this in the 1930s with the unemployed councils during the Great Depression, the Communist Party. Communist Party candidates in the 1931 mayoral election in Salt Lake City poll 15% of the vote, running the top half of seven candidates. And they're contesting office at the state and local, state and local office as well. Throughout the late 1940s and the 1950s, a group called the Socialist Workers' Party, which has a strong tie to Utah because of one of their founding members, a guy named Joseph Hansen and his wife, Reba Hansen, is very active promoting socialist views. Obviously, by the time you get to the 1960s, you have a whole rebirth of radicalism in Utah, as you do around the country, and there's an active SDS chapter in Salt Lake City and Utah. There's an active anti-war movement and a Peace and Freedom Party. And all the aspects that we see nationally are found in Utah. I think the difference is that in that period from 1900 to 1920, socialists were able to be elected to office and able to have an impact, as John mentioned, in the day-to-day operation of government, for example. After the Socialist Party declines here and nationally, they never ever really have that kind of an impact. But some sort of radical tradition permeates Utah and continues to this day, I would submit to you, that there are still activists who believe in the democratic management and of the important aspects of society. Hmm. So there's a legacy.
There's a legacy, as you argue. The book, A History of Utah Radicalism, I mean, this radical, fringy group has been here since the state was founded. What difference does it make? We haven't heard a lot about it over the many years of our Utah state history. This book is out now. I mean, why should we care?
Yeah, that's, well, a good question, and one we try to address. First of all, it's a neglected part of Utah history, so we're trying to bring that to people's attention. But just quickly, a general answer is that the way we think about the past influences the way we think about present and future. If we think about the past as mainly the story of one people, one set of ideas, one experiences, one set of values, that leads to one set of thoughts about the present and the future. If, on the other hand, we say the history of Utah has always been the history of many peoples and values and ideas, and one an example of that is a radical tradition, then that leads to a whole different, I think, orientation about the present and the future. Academic named Carrie Nelson wrote an article with the title, "What Happens When You Put the Left at the Center?" And his answer is it opens up a whole range of possibilities, not just a way of looking at the present and future, but a whole different range of possibilities for acting in the future.
John McCormick, we'll have to leave it there. John McCormick, Dean of the School of Humanities and Social Science at Salt Lake Community College. Thank you, sir, very much for your time.
You're welcome.
John Sillitoe, Adjunct Professor at Weber State University. Professor Sillitoe, thanks to you.
Pleasure.
Pleasure.
And John McCormick and John Sillitoe are co-authors of the new book, A History of Utah Radicalism, Startling, Socialistic, and Decidedly Revolutionary. It's the winner of this year's Utah State History Best History Book Award, and they will be accepting that award as well as launching the 60th annual Utah State History Conference this weekend at Fort Douglas. And you can find a lot more detail on our website, kcpw.org. Coming up next, the U.S. Constitution reexamined, but first a break. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce, and this is City Views. Happy anniversary, U.S. Constitution. At 225 years old, the U.S. Constitution is the oldest written national constitution in continuous use in the world. Today on the program, we're talking about the document that continues to guide our laws, our politics, and our society with Judge Carolyn McHugh. She's the presiding judge of the Utah Court of Appeals. She was appointed by Governor John Huntsman in 2005, and she currently serves as a member of the Judicial Conduct Commission, a member of the Commission on Character and Civic Education, chairperson of the Standing Committee on Court Technology, etc., etc. Judge McHugh will be part of a short program marking the 225th anniversary of the signing of the Constitution this afternoon, and Judge McHugh joins me in studio. Judge McHugh, it's great to have you here. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you for having me. I'm always excited to speak about the Constitution.
It's a great topic. And again, a short program marking this significant anniversary of the Constitution is happening this afternoon, September 17th at 12:30 in the rotunda of the Matheson Courthouse, 450 South State Street. And you can join our conversation as well if you've got questions or comments about America's founding document. Give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Judge McHugh, the Constitution outlines the framework of our government. It guarantees the rights of citizens. It really is considered this guiding document for our laws. When you think about the history, the story of how the framers drafted this document, what strikes you as the most puzzling or the most impressive part of that story?
Well, I think the most impressive is how much the men, and it was all men, who were involved in the Constitutional Convention studied how best to form a government. And they drew upon a lot of different sources, Locke and Montesquieu, and even the We the People language comes from the Iroquois Nation and their Confederacy of Tribes language. So they were really committed and dedicated to spend hours and hours and hours locked in an unair-conditioned room in Philadelphia to battle out what would be the best document that they could come up, not only for themselves, but they understood that it had to stand the test of time. And it's really an impressive effort.
You've been on the Court of Appeals, as I mentioned, for a number of years. How have your views on the Constitution changed since becoming a judge?
I think that when you're in private practice or you're in other aspects of your life, there are certain provisions that you really don't come into contact with very much. And when you're particularly if you haven't been charged with a crime, and I'll knock on wood, not yet. But when you really start studying the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, which of course was not part of the original draft mm-hmm. of the Constitution that came out of the Constitutional Convention, but was added as part of the ratification process and actually adopted, I think, in 1791. You look at it and you think of how important it is to remember that these are the principles that we govern ourselves by, because political winds will change. And if you read the Federalist Papers, they knew that. And they said there are certain things, certain rights endowed by our Creator that are non-negotiable. And I think that it really kind of gives you chills when you look at it, to think of how thoughtful the framers were, and when you're applying the law and you've taken an oath because of the Supremacy Clause, which was hotly contested by the Anti-Federalists, even state judges like myself have to take an oath that we will enforce the U.S. Constitution as the supreme law of the land. And so we have a hierarchy in the law, and you start with the U.S. Constitution. So it brings it home every time you have a federal constitutional issue of where you start, and you start with the language of that document drafted 225 years ago today.
Is the language archaic? I mean, is it difficult for the average Joe to read?
Well, I mean, I don't know if it's difficult for the average Joe or the average Jane to read. The language is archaic in the sense that we don't talk like that anymore. But I think that, if you read it carefully, I mean, it's not really a long document.
Mm-mm.
And there are some things that are very specific because they wanted to be specific. For example, you know, there's just no doubt that you can't house soldiers for free in citizens' homes during peacetime without the permission of the homeowner, right? I mean, that's pretty specific. But other things, you know, liberty, pursuit of happiness are broader. And I think in a lot of ways, they were intentionally broader and vaguer so that when they knew exactly what they were talking about and put it in, otherwise they were trying to look at not only today, but for future generations were drafting this document.
Mm.
So I think it's, and truthfully, you know, they were, I do this respectfully, very paranoid about concentration of power. And rightly so, because they had just fought a war where they felt that they had to break off from England because they didn't feel as if they were given any voice in government. And the last thing they wanted to do, you had the Confederacy of the states that was during the Revolutionary War, but it was completely impractical because the states were all sort of operating autonomously, the national government really didn't have any ability to enter into treaties. Even the Treaty of Paris, which ended the Revolutionary War, a lot of the states were blatantly violating it, kind of with an attitude of, you're not the boss of me. And so they had to sit down and figure out a way to give the federal government enough power to do what it needed to do to function as a nation in the world without intruding too much on not only what I call the vertical separation of powers, which is the what we call federalism, which is that the states only gave up so much power to the federal government, and everything we didn't specifically tell you you could do, you can't do. And what I call the horizontal separation of powers, which is we're not going to concentrate too much power in any branch of this national government. So what we're going to do is we're going to split it out. And the people who make the laws, the legislature, which is Article 1 of the Constitution, are not going to be the people who enforce the laws, which is the executive, Article 2. And the people who interpret the laws are going to be completely removed from any of the political things going on in an independent branch, the judiciary. And it really is a brilliant effort to prevent tyranny, which is what they were worried about.
Speaking with Judge Carolyn McHugh, she's the presiding judge of the Utah Court of Appeals, and she and others will be participating in a short program marking the 225th anniversary of the signing of the U.S. Constitution. It's being held this afternoon, September 17th at 12:30 in the rotunda of the Matheson Courthouse, 450 South State here in Salt Lake City. If you'd like to join us, if you've got questions or comments about the U.S. Constitution, this document that we revere, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. You mentioned, Judge McHugh, that many of the phrases are very explicit. There's no gray area in there. But there is a certain elasticity to some of the phrases, that, you know, gives you a job as a judge, I mean, to interpret the laws. I mean, what do you think is the most misunderstood passage of the Constitution that you've come across?
Well, I don't know if I know what the most misunderstood passage in the Constitution is. And of course, the state courts, in addition, the Supremacy Clause says that we uphold the federal constitution, but we also follow the interpretation of that constitution of the U.S. Supreme Court. So once the U.S. Supreme Court interprets a constitutional phrase, that becomes the supreme law of the land. And I think the tension today is not entirely, but to some extent, a tension about what is the correct procedure when, first of all, is something clear from the language? You know, how do you decide whether this language is clear and interpret it the way it was intended? The frame, because we can't, you know, have a seance and bring everybody back. And even if you could, they may
probably
not
agree.
That's right. They may not all agree on what it meant, because frankly a lot of things we deal with today weren't before them. But I think a lot of the tension today is how do you deal with a situation that wasn't anticipated? Do you have some members of the Supreme Court and take the position that you have these very specific grants of power, and if it's not clear that it was given the power to restrict this, right, then it wasn't. And if you want to change that, you need to go through the process of amending the Constitution. Other of the justices look at it and say, well, we can extrapolate from what they said what they would have intended today. And it's constant tension. But the vagary in the language allows for disagreement about how you go about it, and I don't think it's a bad thing. Hmm. I think that if everything were spelled out absolutely exactly, as times changed, you would outgrow your Constitution. But the fact that things were written in sort of basic principles of the human condition, it gives you more flexibility to deal with changes. The question is, how do you deal with that? And when is it okay to look at the provision and say, well, this is what they meant by cruel and unusual punishment, for example? Is that an instance, for example, the most recent case I can think of is whether you can execute persons of lower intelligence. And there is a dispute among the Supreme Court about whether you do that by saying they must have cruel and unusual punishment means that you can't do that, or whether you say we need to amend the Constitution if we want to change that.
Hmm.
And I think that's kind of the basic tension, not exactly, and there's always variations because the nine of them don't agree on everything.
I mean, is that part of the hardest part of your job, is to crawl into the brains of the founders and try and figure out what the original intent was, or to figure out how the law applies today? And you know what I mean?
Well, I think as a state court judge, you're not seeing it as often. And a lot of times, if you're dealing with issues of the Fourth Amendment or the Fifth Amendment, or the ones that we see all the time in criminal cases, you have guiding principles. So, like most things in law, you have a decision interpreting it that tells you what the rationale is for the decision. And although your fact situation is a little different, what you're trying to do is to take that to start with the language and then take the rationale of how that language is interpreted and apply it to your fact situation. Because the one thing I've learned after 7 years is no matter how settled you think the law is, that there's some clever lawyer out there who can find some nuance that hasn't been considered before to open up another inquiry.
Our time is short, but you mentioned that there has been this Constitution was crafted to be flexible, to change over time. Do you think it can withstand another 200 years of scrutiny?
I think that the Constitution can withstand another 200 years, another 500 years, so long as our citizens understand how the document works, how their government works, and are willing to stand up and fight for the Constitution. And by that I mean it's like when, at the end of the Constitutional Convention, the people asked Benjamin Franklin, what kind of a government do we have? And he said, a republic, if you can keep it. And by that it means that this document creates, and I know everyone talks about the delicate balance, but it really is a delicate balance that between the states and the national government in terms of the allocation of powers and among those three branches. And I think of it sometimes as taking three playing cards and touching them together so that all of them will stand upright. And you've got to constantly make sure that they're at the right angle or they're all going to fall down. And in order to know what the right angle is, you need to understand how the system of government was designed to work and be committed to protecting those checks and balances and those nuances that make the system work.
Judge Carolyn McHugh, presiding judge of the Utah Court of Appeals. Judge McHugh, thanks so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Judge McHugh will be participating in a short program marking the 225th anniversary of the signing of the U.S. Constitution this afternoon, September 17th at 12:30 in the rotunda of the Matheson Courthouse on State Street. There's more information on our website, kcpw.org. City Views is a production of KCPW News in Salt Lake City. Our technical director is Jesse Ellis. Ryan Cron composed our theme music. Coming up tomorrow, a recipe for preventing violence. Join us for that. For City Views, I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce.